So last week, we started to talk about the upcoming Chag of Purim. And the way in which Purim is about a topsy-turvy world, about Nafochu. And in particular, in the way in which that invitation to turn things on their head, to be revolutionary, to wear masks, to get drunk, was in some ways all about this movement of revelation. That we put on masks to reveal who we truly were, that maybe we drank too much to expose part of ourselves that normally weren't seen. So I want to continue to talk about this a little bit more today and explore some other elements of this dynamic of exploration. We talked last thing about how the willingness or the ability, let's say, to really discover parts of ourselves, to play different roles, to expose who we are, means a willingness to be a fool, to do the unacceptable, to step out of wherever we are at the moment. In the Hasidic tradition, they talk about chutzpah kedosha, holy chutzpah, right? A very important quality. And it's this quality of saying, you know, I know the world says something else. I know this isn't the socially acceptable thing to do at the moment. But I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to act in the way that feels true to me at the moment. Rabbi Nachman of Horodenka said, when you pray, you should just imagine nobody else is around. You're just before God, and you just need to act in whatever way feels right at that moment. In Darchei Tzedek, it teaches, if you're playing with real hitlavut, real fervor, if you sing with a full voice, chant the prayers with vigor and clap your hands, perhaps some people will say, look at him. Who does he think he is? Is he crazy? Forget them and forget about all such considerations. Picture yourself alone before the Holy One. As the rabbi said, it is better to be called a fool your whole life than to be out of God's favor for one moment. It's a wonderful line, right? It's better to be called a fool your whole life than to be out of God's favor for one moment. This is from Darchei Tzedek. I can send you the source. There's the famous story, people may know, of King David, who when they bring the ark up to Jerusalem, dances, right, uninhibitedly and crazily before the ark. And his high-born wife, Michal, Saul's daughter, isn't so impressed, right, with his activity, doesn't think it's so befitting the king. And his answer is that the important thing is that I'm giving honor to God, right? Not to myself. And it's really quite a deep question. It's sort of easy to say, but it's a deep question, which is, would you rather be called a fool and find God, find truth, find openness, find compassion, or be respected and lose God, lose truth? What's more important to you? And I think it's easy to answer that sort of theoretically to say, well, of course, I'd rather find truth and look like a fool. But in the moment, what really counts? What are you really willing to do in that moment? What's really most important in that moment? It's like, I think I mentioned this before, and my teacher said, you know, she said, if you could be given enlightenment right now, totally awake, but you had to work in the back of a 7-Eleven for the rest of your life, would you take it? You know, would you take that deal? And it's like, well, I don't know, right? It's a little uncomfortable. But it's crazy, right? If you could be completely awake, act with wisdom and compassion in every moment, be full of love, not suffer, transform the world in your very being, but you couldn't play out all those stories. You couldn't be a big success. People wouldn't respect you. You wouldn't have the title. You wouldn't have the position. You wouldn't have whatever it is you think you're supposed to have. Would you take it? So it's hard for us to do that. And Purim makes it a little bit easier. Because it's a time when it's socially acceptable to be a fool, right? So one time when we get to sort of practice being a fool and then maybe make ourselves a little more willing, a little more able to do it the rest of the year, the rest of the time. And in this way, really this whole practice, and really the practice of Purim, the masks of Purim, is just about truth. It's just about truth. It's how do we let our full selves come out. How do we let these masks be, in a certain sense, the clouds of Sinai, right? The clouds of Revelation, who sort of cover over the mountain on one level in order to make room for revelation on the other. It's what it means to be a Talmid Chacham. In Avot, it lists seven characteristics of a sage. And two of them are about something he has not heard, he says, I have not heard. And he acknowledges the truth. And again, I mentioned these things, they seem like such small things, but how often have we sort of, somebody said something to us and we've acted as if we know what's going on, and we've seen that, and we heard that, and we saw that movie, or whatever it is, right? The most trivial elements. And we didn't instead just say, oh yeah, don't know what you're talking about, right? Didn't see that. Don't understand that, actually. Right? Just that simple. For some reason, it's just a little bit enough uncomfortable that we're not willing to do it. Right? Our automatic response is just to play along. And so there's this tremendous bravery, really, that's required in real honesty. One of my teachers, Sylvia Borstein, summarized the practice we do as saying, pay attention, tell the truth, don't duck. Right? That's the whole thing. It's like, just pay attention, just tell the truth, and then don't duck. Because that's our tendency. It's like, oh, just jump out of the way when something too uncomfortable happens. Just don't duck. And what's beautiful about this, Avram Kalisker talks about this process of sharing in a spiritual community. And he says, when you're really honest with each other, then you let go of shame, and then true communication can happen. Right? Because when we're genuinely honest with each other, there's, I think, a deep recognition in us and in others that, right, oh, we're just human. Of course I have all these crazy thoughts. Of course I have all these things that feel shameful and embarrassing and unacceptable, because that's just what it means to be a human being. And when we can share that, shame no longer has to block both our communication with others and our own experience of ourselves. Rabbi Chanina taught in Shabbat that truth is the seal, it's the chotem of the Holy One. This deep commitment to truth, because where truth is found, that is where divinity is found. And it's a kind of warrior-like passion, a toughness, a leaping into battle. It's an exposing every bit of ourselves, which is this wildness of Purim, this willingness to just rip away the veils in a certain way and expose who we truly are. And it's interesting, because often when I think about truth in this way or talk about truth, I often think, and I think that may have arisen to your mind as well, that we're just unwilling to look at and experience the sort of bad parts of ourselves, the yucky parts, the parts that don't feel good, the parts that feel unacceptable in some way, parts that are shameful. But what the Pizetzner says is that, bizarrely enough, we're also afraid to experience our hope and our joy and our pleasure and our sense of adventure and our bravery. Perhaps it's because we know they often lead to disappointment and hurt. If we have hope, for instance. Perhaps we're just scared of exposing ourselves. That's a little bit too vulnerable, a little bit too dangerous to really experience our joy, to really be joyous, to really just let it come out. Maybe we're starting to do something new, and instead of just feeling that joy and excitement about it, we feel worried. Maybe we hold back the joy because it feels too risky. It feels like we might get hurt. And you can just reflect for a moment. Are there times when you hold back your joy and your excitement? You know, often, unfortunately, being really joyful and excited also isn't socially acceptable, right? It's like, that's not the proper way to behave. You're not supposed to really just be like, this is amazing. I'm so excited. I'm so happy. I want to dance. I want to sing. I want to smile. I just want to let it all out. For some reason, that isn't allowed. And so in that way, we're scared often even of our own power, our grandeur, and our greatness. We hold back from it rather than just leaping into it. And we cover it over. The Pesetner says we'll have sort of joy arise. It'll feel uncomfortable or inappropriate, and so we'll go, you know, have a drink or eat some food or chat with a friend. Anything to keep things on the kind of, you know, gray in-between state that doesn't feel too challenging, too much, too out of the ordinary. The Magid of Mezrich said to Rav Zusia, you can learn 10 principles of service from a child and a thief. From a child you can learn that they're happy for no particular reason, that they're never idle, and that when they need something, they demand it vigorously, right? These are great lessons, right? To be just happy for no particular reason. It doesn't have to be a cause. Just touching that joy and that happiness that's there in us, that's available at any moment. And when you need something, to demand it vigorously. There's no contradiction between that joy and that happiness and the recognition of desire, of want. He says from a thief, you can learn that he does his service by night. If he doesn't finish in one night, he does it the next. That he loves his fellow workers. That he risks his life for slight gains. That what he takes has so little value, he gives it up for slight coin. That he endures blows and hardships and doesn't care. And that he likes his trade and wouldn't trade it for another. There's something very interesting in that sense of the devotion of the thief. Of risking his life for slight gains. How much are we willing to risk for the greatest of gains? The greatest of gains. For love. For happiness. For connection. For touching our divine nature. Alan Cohen, a teacher, said, it takes a lot of courage to release the familiar and seemingly secure. To embrace the new. But there is no real security in what is no longer meaningful. There is more security in the adventurous and exciting, for in the movement there is life, and in change there is power. I love that line in the middle. There is no real security in what is no longer meaningful. I sort of imagine everybody who shows up here has felt that in some way. It's like, we could just stick with what we know, but somehow we've already discovered it's just not meaningful. It isn't really secure. We don't ultimately feel safe in those places of what we know and that which is no longer serving us. And so when we're really willing to be honest, then we're really willing to face all of our experience, all of our experience. To just sort of give it a huge bear hug, to maybe dance with it, with our joy and our sadness, with our fear and our hope, with our jealousy and our love. It's a wonderful story about Rosh Hashanah, where the Baal Shem Tov teaches one of his students, Rav Wovkitzkis, all these complicated kavanot about the shofar. I'm supposed to do everything in a particular moment, and each shofar blast is supposed to have this intention. But Rav Kitzkis is so anxious that he forgets them all. Actually, Rosh Hashanah, he spent like months studying this, but Rosh Hashanah itself completely forgets them all. He's completely anxious, and he is so distraught by the fact he has this huge task, and he's forgotten them all. He's forgotten all the covenant. So he just weeps. He just weeps and blows the shofar. And the Baal Shem Tov said, he said, ah, you know, the kavanot I gave you are like keys. You need the right key for each door to open the doors to get higher and higher. But true grief is like an axe, which just breaks down all the doors. You know, true emotion is this axe. It's like, right, there are all these techniques, all these particular ways, and then you can just feel it, and the doors just explode. The doors just explode. Nothing stands in your way. And so we feel joy, and we feel sorrow. And we can do it at any moment. At any moment. I wrote once, would that I had loved enough. Would that I had loved enough to give my whole being in a single moment. Would that the doubts and fears of this fleeting life had not stayed my hand, my heart. Would that I could die into every moment and be born anew. Would that my love knew no bounds, no barriers, no holding, no limits. But I would, at any moment, in any instant, and the light shines brighter than 1,000 suns. It's that light, the light of the sun, the light, as the Midrash says, which is hidden away for the tzaddikim from the 6 days of creation. It's a light that's actually always available to us. We feel like we've missed it. In any moment we notice, why haven't I just opened my heart? Oh, I can just open my heart. It's like at that very moment of having that feeling of regret, of why not X, we can just be an X for a moment. We can just do it at that moment. But of course, so often we're held back. One of the things that hold us back, of course, as we've talked about, is our fear. Our fear of just being fully ourselves, of opening to who we truly are. But another huge element that holds us back is expectations. Other people's, ours, society's. And one of the beautiful things about Purim, I think, is it's all about letting go of expectations. Of decorum, of what's expected, of letting the wild soul come out. Often when we don't live up to somebody's expectations, we feel bad, disappointed, worthless, that we let them down, scared maybe that they'll hate us, maybe we feel like a failure. But one of I feel like the fundamental insights I've gained from this practice is that it's not my job to fulfill other people's expectations. Just not my job. That has absolutely nothing to do with my job in life. I have a job to act wisely. I have a job to act with compassion. I have a job to try and heal the world. But I don't have a job to do what other people expect me to do. Joan Didion said, to free us from the expectations of others, to give us back to ourselves. There lies the great singular power of self-respect. Another line, to give us back to ourselves. Right? It's precisely this. It's like, oh, giving yourself back to yourself, taking yourself out of the hands of everybody else who somehow thinks they have ownership over you. And to do that, which is the really hard part, in my experience, you have to be willing to let the person, that other person, be disappointed in you, right? It has to be okay with you that they're going to be disappointed. Because it's not that, well, I'm not going to live up to their expectations, but then somehow I'm going to do that, I'm going to make them feel the right way about it, right? They're going to be disappointed. They're going to wish you'd lived up to their expectations. And it can be really hard. But it's just not our job. Our job is to ask, is this right? Is this genuine? Is this motivated by a good intention right now? Am I doing the best thing I can do at this moment? Whether or not it's what the other person expects. There's the old joke, right? The meditation student goes and buys a magazine, gives the guy a $10 bill, asks for his change. The guy says, change must come from within. Right? Well, the truth is, as we all know, that that's the only place it comes from. It can't come from the expectations of others. Even what seems like the best expectations. You know, it has to come from inside ultimately. It can't come from our fear of disappointing people. That's never genuine, right? The responses from that fear are never genuine. They're never the deepest place of knowing what's really right in this life. And the other side of that fear of others' expectations is the fear that I'll abandon myself. I'll sort of give away my own needs to help another. You know, I certainly have had this experience that somehow this need to please others comes in, and fear of disappointing them, and so now you give away your own integrity, or you give away what you know to be true for yourself for a moment. As we practice and work with this, we get better and better at sort of setting those boundaries, about being clear at what is really required of us in this situation. And I'll say that disappointing others is both scary, but can also be incredibly liberating, right? Incredibly freeing to do it, and also then to do it and recognize, not only did I do it, and not only were they disappointed, it really was the best action in this circumstance. It really produced the most good. It may even led to an interesting conversation and development and something new coming out of it, because it wasn't the expected. And when we're present, we sort of drop both poles of that fear, the fear of not fulfilling others' expectations and the fear of kind of abandoning myself and not doing what is right for myself, of being trampled on. Because there's a clear sense that it's really not about either of those things. Both of those poles are sort of irrelevant. It's not about sort of what is right for myself in some kind of theoretical way or what feels right for my personality. It's not about the other person's expectations. It's just about a very clear decision of what's called for right now. What's called for right now? Walt Whitman, one of my favorite poets, said, "Re-examine all that you have been told in school or in church or in any book. Dismiss whatever insults your soul." I think it's good advice. Right? Like, investigate. Investigate what's being said, what's being told to you, what's being taught to you. And if it insults your soul, just dismiss it. You don't have to take it on, whatever the baggage is. And the problem is that so often we don't recognize what insults our soul, right? Because we don't stop. We just get a request, there's an expectation, and immediately we're jumping into it. We're like, let's go. We're already falling into whatever our pattern is. And so this is the place of mindfulness, to just stop for a moment and to investigate. It's like, oh, they expect me to do this. Does that make sense? Is that reasonable? Should I do this? And then the beauty of it is not only that we say no when we should say no, but the gift to both ourselves and others is that our yes is a genuine yes, right? It's not a yes of guilt, of feeling coerced, of being like, fine, I'll do it. It's like, oh, right, yes, yes, happy to do that, love to do that. That's something that's the right thing to do right now. It's so much more spacious and open and loving between every person in that relationship in that moment. And our own expectations, something to really watch out for, you know, can be just as difficult, just as sort of poisonous. There's nothing wrong with setting goals for ourselves. They can be very positive and skillful. It's great to have goals. But that goal has to be matched with this realization that we're not in control, that it isn't just up to us whether those goals are achieved. It's like shooting an arrow. You know, you set up, you train for it, you should do all the things you can do to be the best archer you can. And then you let the arrow go, and then you're done. Right? You can't do anything. A huge gust of wind could come and blow the arrow. A bird could swoop down and like pick it up in its beak and fly away, right? You can't control that. You can't control that. But we feel we're supposed to kind of like run with the arrow to the target and stick it into the bullseye, right? Like that's what we normally feel like. We have to control every part of the process. So it's not that there's no effort involved or there's no part of our own preparation and act, but we're never in control of the big picture. The picture is always wider than us. So it's like setting a goal and doing what you can and then letting go, just like the arrow. You let go and then it's out of your hands. And you see what happens next. It's the meaning of bitachon, of emunah, of this deep trust, of our willingness to let go and surrender. A willingness to let go and surrender, which is a knowing, in a certain sense, that life and people will disappoint us. I don't mean that in a bad sense. It's just that you, nor anybody else, is ever going to live up to everything you want and all of your expectations, right? It's just the nature of being humans. We let ourselves and other people down sometimes. Every human being has done that. Right? There's never been a human being who has never let anybody down. So even that process of just sort of trust, loving, trusting people, we trust with the awareness that, oh, and it might not work out. I totally trust you and it might not work out. I trust the situation. It might not work out. That's just the reality of the situation. It's just the reality of our life. And when we recognize that, we can relax. We can relax. I was talking to my teacher, Amita, once, and she said, you know, it's hard being general manager of the universe, right? Like when we think we're general manager of the universe, it's hard. There's a lot to manage. There's a lot to take care of. There's a lot to get done. There's a lot to control. We got to make sure the stock's in and everything's going on in the whole world. But it's not our job, right? It's actually not your job. It's nobody's job to be general manager of the universe. And part of that is really a movement of humility. There's a kind of pride in our thinking that it all depends on us. It's all up to us. If I don't do it, it won't happen. If I'm not there, it won't be right. If I don't do all these pieces, it'll never work out properly. But the reality is, who knows what'll happen? It might work out properly, it might not. It might work out even better. It might. Sometimes it does. Frederick Douglass said, "I prefer to be true to myself, even at the hazard of incurring the ridicule of others, rather than to be false and to incur my own abhorrence." I think it's actually quite a sad line, because I think it's something many of us do. We're false to ourselves in some way, because we're scared of the ridicule of others, because we're scared of our joy, because we're scared of our pain, because we're scared of disappointment or failure or being different. Who knows what it is? And then our response, which also isn't helpful or skillful, is our own abhorrence, our own anger at ourselves, our own disappointment with ourselves, our own shame. And we don't need to be caught there. You know, we don't need to be caught in that choice of abhorrence and falseness. We can move rather towards this place of truth, which is this place of chutzpah kedosha, of holy chutzpah, right? Just having the, you know, the ball sometimes to just do whatever it is that needs to be done. To surrender, to let go, to dance wildly, to dress up as something else, to get drunk, to lose control. to not have to live up to everybody's expectations. And in that way, on Purim, we can achieve genuine freedom, real revelation, real surrender. We talked about at the beginning of this talk that it's taught that Yom Kippur is Kippurim. It's the day Kippurim. Because both of them are days of this genuine revelation of who we are. This genuine acknowledging of who we are and who we've been in the past year. One through sort of stepping back, and one through fully jumping in. And so there's actually a freedom, and even paradoxically it may seem, I think, a purification that can happen in that place of freedom, the purification of genuinely admitting our desires, our wants, our craziness, our fear, our anger. In Purim, there's a place for it all. And we can put on each of those masks. We can wear each of those masks and play them out in Purim. Just play them out. We can play out all those different selves and identities, all the different people we could be and we are. And in doing so, in playing them out, we can discover ourselves. So we'll pause here for today. As is usually the case, we now have a little bit of time, about 15 minutes, for thoughts, sharing, questions, answers, etc.
We're expected to be crazy. And I mean, that's fine, but I've always, like, while you're talking, the thing that I was always thinking about, like, I have issues with, like, dressing up. Like, not because I don't want to, but because I like, what should I be? And how can I be creative and all these things? And I never come up with anything. But, like, there's that like, other expectation of, like, you have to be dressed awesomely and crazy. Act like, you know, wild and get drunk and dance around. So, like, I don't know, how do you like balance that?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think the first thing I would ask is, despite the expectation of being crazy on Purim, how crazy are we really? Like, how, despite the permission given, so when you investigate it yourself, despite the permission given, how willing are you to really take a risk? Which doesn't mean just putting on a costume. It doesn't mean getting drunk, right? Because that's just the external thing. Like, anybody can have a bunch of drinks, right? But the invitation of the kind of things we've talked about to really let out those feelings and to play sort of those personas of, like, to be Haman. You know what I mean? I mean, I think that's one of the amazing things, to dress up in Purim and be Haman. It's like, all right, anger, violence, jealousy, craving power, right, all in me. Right? All in me. So how willing are we to really be Haman? And yeah, and that's right, there's expectations in that situation as well. And so how do we work with those? You know, I mean, in my family, I'll just say, Debbie, for instance, is like constantly disappointed by my Purim costumes. She's like, you never have a real costume. You just take a bunch of colorful stuff. You wrap some stuff around your head, some stuff around your body. You're like, costume! <You know? laughs> And it's true, like, I'm never really something. But I feel pretty good about that. Like, so, like, I'm wrapping things around my head, I get to dance, I don't know, it's fine, right? But to even explore with that, it's like, okay, right, so costume. So where can I really play with that? What would help me really feel like I'm exploring, I'm coming out, I'm, you're really coming out. I mean, I feel like that's sort of the essential metaphor. It's like, how do you come out of the closet in all the ways that we all hide? It's all the ways we all hide. And Purim gives permission for that. Now, of course, the point is not just to do it on Purim. But my experience is, how hard is it to do it even on Purim? You know, how hard is it, like, to really let go? And some of you really want to let go. Like, whatever it is, you know what I mean? When you really are sort of being given permission. And yet still, you kind of do it, kind of hold back at the same time. Kind of be a little ginger, kind of be a little bit worried about what people are going to say about you, even in that moment of permission. And how much harder is it to do it the rest of the year?
was sort of confused during the discussion of, you know, sort of doing what's right, and perhaps that would cause disappointment of someone else.
Yeah.
And I'm just wrestling with myself, what exactly is the right thing to do? I feel like there are certain times in which I really don't want to do something, but at the same time, I feel like it would be the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Anyway, so should I, in that moment, try to be selfish and say, I don't want to do it, I shouldn't do it? Or should I say, it is the right thing to do, so I should do it? You know, there's that.
Yeah. What I'd say is, what I was trying to describe is how do we do the right thing to do, which is separate from expectation, right? If you're doing it because it's the right thing to do, then yeah, you should do it.
Even if you don't want to.
Even if you don't want to. It's not about wanting, right? It's not about wanting. It's about not doing things because they're expected, but doing them rather because they're the right thing to do. But, and now I want to take this a little step further, is that, however, that tension between wanting and recognizing it's the right thing to do can only occur when we're disconnected from our actual experience. Because when we're fully connected, we just know it's the right thing to do. Doesn't mean it's not sort of still hard in certain ways, but we want to do it because it's the right thing to do, not because we have some intellectual understanding of course it's the right thing to do to whatever the thing is. But we feel it concretely and experientially. This is sort of where life is pulling me at this moment. Of course, this is the thing that needs to happen. Fear may still be arising. Other resistances may still be arising. But it isn't that same kind of, I don't want to do it, but I know somewhere out there that it's the right thing to do in some kind of alienated sense. We know it right in here. And then in my experience, at least, it's much easier to do it. You know, we can really feel inside, oh, right, that's what I need to do. Okay, let's take a breath, right? And sort of feel whatever it is that I'm feeling at the moment, all the fear, the resistance to doing that, and then I can take the step forward and do it. And of course, just to reflect on that, it's hard to do that. I mean, so often we don't have the time, or we're not able to touch that space in the moment, and then we do the best we can. You know, that's okay. But as much as possible, it's trying to make that space available where it's not just leaping into expectations or leaping into our own sort of selfish desires, but just trying to actually stop and say, okay, what feels right at this moment? If I sort of feel into my body and just ask my body, what is actually called for at this moment? Then I see what's called for. It's like Sylvia Borstein told me once, she went to talk to a teacher of hers, and she asked him, what is compassion? And he said, there's no such thing as compassion. There's just the recognition of need and the response. And that's like, I feel like, wow, that's like a whole nother, that's like a whole nother step where I'm not at yet. But there's something deeply true there. I sort of, even thinking about it, compassion, sort of adding this whole extra layer. When we're really connected, when we're really present, there's no sort of thought of compassion. It's just like, oh, need, this is what needs to, how I need to respond in this situation. Right? And wise compassion, not to be, you know, what they call a chassid shoteh, right? An idiot chassid, right? Right? So it's not about, and that's when we get, when we're not connected, we get caught into all these false notions of compassion, which again, like serving people's needs, making people happy, thinking we're helping somebody when we're really just enabling them to destroy themselves or hurt themselves in some way or whatever it is we're doing, right? So again, with compassion, that sense of need, it's like, there's a lot of fierceness there. There's a lot of clarity. Like, oh, situation, recognize, what's necessary in this situation? So also just thinking in response to the last two questions. I think one question to ask ourselves in this regard, it's a question I'm asking myself. One is the question of sort of Purim as a place which enables us to do that. Great. Another question is, how do we cultivate this in our lives as much as possible? Just in everyday lives. How do we cultivate this way of being in the world? Great. But I think there's a third very important in-between place, which is, how do we cultivate the contexts that make this as easy for us as possible, right? How do we cultivate the contexts that make this possible for us to make the first baby steps in this direction before we're ready to do it in all of our lives. Whether it's a small group of friends, or it's dancing by ourselves in our house, or I don't know what it is for you. You know, whatever it might be for you, or doing, making a specific plan. I'll mention when I was working on this very concretely, you know, and having a lot of nervousness about expectations from my bosses, right, people I started employed by, etc. So when I felt like I needed to in some way challenge or disappoint their expectations or change it, so I would sort of plan it, right? Like, okay, this is really hard, it's scary, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do the moment, so this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go in, I'm going to say this, you know, sort of rehearse in my head to just get the feeling of, okay, and I take that step, and then you know what? The sky would not fall, right? You did it, I did it, and like, oh, it was okay. It was actually okay. The sky didn't fall, I didn't get fired. It wasn't a terrible disaster. It was actually quite productive to figure out like what was happening next and you know how we were going to relate and how we were going to work. Good, right? And then you learn. So whatever, you know, it's sort of totally up to you, but it's a creative process. Whatever's going to help you try to create those contexts or take those steps where that's going to be possible. And that, of course, a lot about is recognizing where is it hard for me? Oh, where am I hitting the resistance? Can I create some context of just helping me work through that resistance? It's very hard to just do. It's much easier when you create some context of support for it. Let's just sit for five more minutes.